All right, so thank you very much for coming and learning with me. So we're going to talk a bit about the obligation to serve in the IDF, the halachic obligation, the October 7th attack, and the subsequent war with Hamas, and the threat of a future war with Hezbollah has highlighted the need for more soldiers to serve in the IDF. Meanwhile, the Haredi community as a whole, and certainly the Haredi leadership, rejects the position that they're obligated to serve in the army. And the fact, I haven't even started yet.
Not every Israeli Jew.
What? Right, right. I said that every Israeli citizen, right, Jewish citizen, fine, it's fair. Okay, so that they are, the fact that many in the religious Zionist camp in Israel have been serving, and some have died in the war, whereas the Haredim as a whole have not been serving, has been a source of tension, where one group of people are putting their lives on the line, whereas another group is not. In 1948, 400 yeshiva students, or 0.07% of the Israeli population, maybe that might be the Jewish Israeli population, were exempted from army service. In 1948, when Ben-Gurion made the deal that yeshiva students are exempt, that was 0.07%. In 1952, David Ben-Gurion went to Bnei Brak to visit the Chazon Ish with his assistant and future Israeli president, Yitzhak Navon. Ben-Gurion asked, "How will we, religious and non-religious Jews, live together without exploding from within? We have different views. How do we live together?" And the Chazon Ish quoted a passage. Before we get to that, just want to point out that the first four sources I have here are just recent articles that have come out in the record high. This is from February 21st, 2024. 66 Haredim received an exemption from military service in the past year. Jerusalem Post, February 28th. The Defense Minister Gallant says, "If the wide consensus is not achieved, I will not be submitting the conscription law at the behest of the Defense Minister. We need something that there's consensus regarding Haredim being drafted by the IDF. The Sephardic Chief Rabbi infamously said in March 10th, 2024, hard to know whether he was saying that seriously or whether he was just giving it as an exaggeration. If they try to force Haredim to enlist, we'll go abroad. And then we also, however, there was, on March 14th, the Haredi parties discussed with the Gedolim a new draft law for Haredim not studying full-time, so maybe there's some movement. Now, what I was quoting to you about this, the next source was the Gemara that the Chazon Ish quoted to David Ben-Gurion in 1952, where after Ben-Gurion said, "How can we live together?" So he quotes this Gemara. I'm sorry, I apologize. It's not this Gemara. I apologize. He quoted a Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin. Right. Sorry. Yes, Evan. Yes, correct. So he quoted a Gemara from Maseches Sanhedrin that says there are different versions as to what the exact parable was, exact Moshe was. But basically, if two wagons or two boats or two camels are approaching a narrow bridge and from opposite directions, and there isn't room for the two of them, the empty the wagon must give way to the full one. And Chazon Ish said, "We, the Haredi community, bear the burden of Torah and mitzvot, therefore the non-religious Zionists must defer to us and move out of our way." According to Navon, the Chazon Ish continued that the Orthodox bear the burden of religious law, while the secular do not feel bound by it. The Chazon Ish was not even able to agree, according to Navon, that the learners' lives were protected by those serving in the army. Rather, he insisted that it is only thanks to the fact that we learn Torah that the soldiers are able to exist. From 400 students, last year's 66,000 received exemption from military service. And, you know, when they talk about since the war, some Haredim have enlisted, so the number was 540. So it's again, some, but it's obviously out of 66,000 received exemptions, 540 Haredim decide to enlist. There have been attempts in the government to force or to convince more Haredim to enlist in the army, especially after October 7th. And But it's obviously very challenging. So the question I'd like to sort of just go over, so we're familiar, so we can be familiar with what's the nature of the halachic debate. I'm sure I'm speaking to an audience now who is on sort of one side, I assume for the most part, is on one side of the debate. But I just want to sort of share with you so we can be more literate and more knowledgeable about what is the nature of the machlokas, the nature of the debate between the Haredi position and the non-Haredi position. You know, why do the Haredim say they don't have to enlist in the army halachically? And what's the counter argument? So we'll go through sort of three or four different general perspectives. So one argument is that there's a Gemara in Bava Basra, Dav Chesam and Aleph. The Gemara says, "Va'amar Ravasi, Amar Rav Yochanan." Rav Yochanan says, "Hakol lefasei ha'ir, va'filu miyasme." So everyone in the town, when they're contributing to different communal works, so I don't know if they were like taxes or not taxes, like who pays for what, right? Should the people in this room pay membership if some of it goes to youth programming, right? You're not using it, right? Maybe grandkids, okay. So these are interesting questions. Like in other words, you have a community, right? And you have certain funds go to certain activities. And who should pay for those activities? Should it be the whole community? Should it be only people who benefit from that activity? These are interesting questions, right? So when it comes to this question about, the Gemara talks about this. So even when they're contributing for columns of the city, so money is collected even from orphans. But the Gemara says, Avo Rabbanan lo, but the sages are not required to contribute. The Rabbanan lo tzricha nitirusa, since the sages do not need protection. Amar Rav Papa, Lishura, Ula Parashi, Ula Tarzina, Afila Miyasmi, Avo Rabbanan lo tzricha nitirusa. So there is this Gemara, which says that for the city wall, for the city horsemen, and for the guards. So there is a belief that the rabbis, by studying full time, so again, you can agree or you can disagree whether this is true or not, but there is a position in the Gemara which says, and it's quoted actually by the Rambam. The Rambam writes that kol hadvarim shetzrichem lishmira sa'ir, that all things, and the Rambam was like a rationalist, you know, like you talk about, you know, different types of rabbinic Jews, and so some rabbinic Jews were mystics, and they believe in, you know, perhaps more mystical ideas, and some rabbis are more rationalists, you have to live in this world. So it's interesting, the Rambam, who is known to be a rationalist, right, so he quotes this Gemara in Hilchos Shechedim, and he says that all things that are needed for protection of the city, lokhi mikol anshei ha'ir, we take from the inhabitants, filu mina yisomim, from the orphans, chutz min talmid chachamim, we don't take it from sages. She'ein talmid chacham tzrichin shmira shetar shem ratan. So the Rambam, the rationalist, I'm just saying, it's just fascinating. You could agree or disagree with the Rambam, you could agree or disagree with the Gemara. So the Gemara and the Rambam quotes the halacha that when you're paying for, let's say, for example, right, the equivalent would be, you know, I don't know, is there like a security tax or the security fee here? So maybe however you define the Torah scholars, whatever that means, so they won't have to pay for this because the Torah protects them. Yeah, what do you want to say, Myrna?
That was my question. How do you define Torah?
Yeah, so I don't know the answer. Whatever that means, we can ask it. But how do you deal with this question? Right, that's an interesting question. Like, is it everyone? Is the people learning full time? How much do you have to learn? But this it's an interesting question in general, sort of how we deal with that. Yeah, Howie? Right. Right. So the question is right. So the question is maybe there's a difference. Maybe there's a difference in general whether it's a whether in general maybe they don't need protection, but maybe when there's a dangerous time, maybe it might apply. So you can sort of ask when this apply, when this doesn't apply. So maybe there's a distinction there. But this is fascinating, Gemara, fascinating Rambam. And you can deal with all these theological questions. If we know that you can make the argument that people were killed, maybe, and maybe you can say that they undergo that risk. But they don't have to. They're not financially responsible because they are protected. Now, Rav Lichtenstein deals with this question. Rav Lichtenstein wrote, if you want to, part of the material that I have in terms of presenting some of the arguments is from a somewhat well-known essay by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein called The Ideology of Hester. So I quoted some passages. You can probably find it online. You can read more. I quoted some key passages from this. So Rav Aaron Lichtenstein deals with a lot of these arguments. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein says that there is, however, no need to pursue this train of thought, for the basic analogy is quite tenuous on purely halachic grounds. And even if what you say is 100% correct, and forget about the question of, we know that many rabbis died in pogroms and the Holocaust and other things, and we don't know how to define them. So even if you grant all that, even if you say, notwithstanding that, the halacha is the halacha, so the payment in question is not inherently normative. It relates to no mitzvah whatsoever. Rather, it derives solely from the obligation to help defray the cost of communal facilities from which one reaps benefit. Now, this is a goal of, if you benefit from something, you should pay for it. If you're not going to benefit from it, you don't have to pay for it. This is obvious from the context. The impost is discussed in the same mission that deals with requiring tenants of a courtyard to pay for a gate or a watchman's booth, or both, in order to keep out trespassers or onlookers. Right? There's a bunch of people living somewhere who has to pay for the watchman, who has to pay for the security guard. Moreover, it is reflected in the fact that the sum is prorated according to the degree of benefit involved. In other words, the more that you benefit, the more you have to pay, with those subject to the greatest risk paying the most. So if you believe somehow, if you're studying a lot of Torah, maybe you get a 10% greater protection, maybe you should pay 10% less. We can debate these points. And he says, hence, those who derive no benefit pay nothing. Right? Tenants without cars do not generally pay for the upkeep of a building's garage. Right? So tenants without cars, right? So they don't pay for the garage. And those who have no television sets may be exempt from sharing in the cost of a central antenna. This situation is radically different, however, with respect to an obligation precisely rooted in the responsibility to help others qua others. He says this Gemara, which is often found. And you say, why don't certain people have to serve the army? Because the Torah protects us. That is not the argument for serving the army. The argument for serving the army is to help other people. Even if we grant all your arguments that this Gemara is normative. Does anyone suppose that one's duty to engage in a defensive milchemes mitzvah to help save the people of Israel from a foe who has descended upon them is based solely on the fact that one is presently or potentially in danger? In other words, let's say, right, what's a milchemes mitzvah? Milchemes mitzvah is a war, among other things, when an adversary is trying to attack the Jewish people. So we have a responsibility to wage war against them. It's called the milchemes mitzvah, right? So it's not only based on, okay, so I can protect myself. He says, in the context of the egocentric ethic of a Mandeville or an Adam Smith, possibly, if you view society as based on a social contract, I have to wage war just to protect myself, then maybe I have to see, what's the likelihood of me getting harmed, me not getting harmed? Is that how we view Milchemes Mitzvah? So maybe, but from a Torah perspective, this would be a strange doctrine. The more so to the extent that we correctly perceive that such action is mandated by the general norm of Gemilus Chasadim, and not just the specific commandment of defensive war. What he's pointing out is that the reason why you serve in the army, even granted everything, okay, I'm being protected, my Torah is going to protect me. Again, I think you can make a strong argument that maybe like now if the harm is greater, are they really being protected? They're not really being protected. It's completely irrelevant to Rav Lichtenstein. The premise of why we go to war, why we wage war, why we serve in the army, is because we have to help other people. It's based on Gemilus Chesed. So this doesn't get you out of doing that, saying, okay, my Torah protects me. What about your responsibility to society? Milchemes Mitzvah is predicated upon not, oh, I'm a customer, so therefore am I getting benefit or not? But it's based on, I care about Klal Yisrael. Consequently, the Gemara in Bava Basra provides no rationale whatsoever for totally exempt Tamid Chacham from military service. They may not require protection. He's like, granted, they don't require protection, which is, again, you can debate that. But others do. And their duty to defend those who have no built-in armor remains. There's the obligation, to Rav Lichtenstein, for Milchemes Mitzvah is not only about what am I benefiting, and do I, you know, am I benefiting or not? It's my responsibility to help Klal Yisrael when they are in a time of danger. Yeah. Yeah, so there might be a difference. There might be a difference from a community standpoint, right? There might be a difference what's called from a communal standpoint. Like, who has to pay for regular upkeep, for regular costs, right? Who pays for this? Who pays for that? Who pays for that? Whoever benefits from that. But Milchemes Mitzvah is not based on that. Milchemes Mitzvah, when the whole nation is attacked, that's different than simply, I say, maintenance, right? When the whole, when Jewish people are being attacked, so then we have a, it's not, you know, that's based on Gemilus Chesed, he wants to say, and not based on am I getting benefit or not. In other words, for your standard, the security guard.
That's different than a security guard.
That may be different than a security guard. Correct, correct. Yeah? Right. Right. Well, not anything. In other words,
right.
So I would say a Milchemes Mitzvah, I don't want to further, you can make it between Milchemes Mitzvah and Milchemes Chova. There's a Milchemes, not anything about the land, anything to increase, like the war, some of the wars of David and Melech, to increase the land, even though it had to do with land, that's a Milchemes Rishus. Anything that God had commanded the Jewish people to wage war against, maybe that's a Malik, maybe it's the conquest of Yeshua, so that'll be a Milchemes Mitzvah. And in addition to that, for our times practically, there's no Milchemes Yeshua nowadays, but for our times practically, a Milchemes Mitzvah or Milchemes Chovah, so I want to call it, that's when the lives of Jewish people are being endangered. Okay, so that's sort of like one argument. And in fact, the Rambam is going to define. To your point, Howie, right? If you look in the next source, the Rambam in Hilchos Malachim, he says, Perakei Halach Aleph, Ein HaMelech Nilcham Tchila El Mechamas Mitzvah. King was Mechamas Mitzvah. Ezel Mechamas Mitzvah. What's a Mechamas Mitzvah? Zel Mechamas Shivas Avim. That's the conquest of Yeshua to conquer seven nations in Eretz Yisrael. Mechamas Amalek, wiping out Amalek. We spoke about that definition in the last year. And va'ezras Yisrael miyad sor shebaleihem, and helping the Jewish people from an adversary that comes upon them. So this is different. And in fact, the Gemara writes in Sota Daf Mendal and Beis. So he says, b'melchemes mitzvah, when a melchemes mitzvah takes shape, when in time of a melchemes mitzvah, so a kol yotzim. Everyone goes out to war. Afilu chasa mechedro v'chala mechupasa. Even a husband, a bride and groom, typo. Oh, no, sorry. No, even a bride and groom go out to war. The Rambam quotes this, right, in Hilchos Melachim Perek Zayin Halacha Dalet, that everyone goes out to war in Milchemes Mitzvah, even a bride and a groom. Now, you can ask me, well, should women go out to war? Which is an interesting topic. Just want to point out, if you turn the page, the Radvaz writes, then he says, wait a second, should women go out to war? It's not our topic now. There are more religious Zionist women who are going out to war now. As we point out, the Radvaz writes, V'chi derech ha-nashim lasos milchama, is it the way of the women to go out to war? He says, because kal mechupasa, even a bride goes out to war from her chupa. He says, V'haksiv kol kvodibas melch panima, should a woman be doing that? She should be more indoors. V'yesh lomar d'halki kamar, kevan d'chasan yotze mechedro, Kala Yotza Mechupasa, what does it mean? The husband leaves his room, the Kala leaves her wedding canopy, She'enon Hegas Yimechupa, she doesn't engage in what it means on one level is that maybe they don't celebrate the 7 days, give me 1 second, the 7 days of Sheva Brachos, but Ve'evshar, he wants to suggest, the Mechemes Mitzvah, Hanashim Hoyim Mesapkos Maim Mazel Balehem, Ve'chein Haminah Hayom Barbio. So, The way the Radvaz understands the idea of a woman going out to war without actually fighting is providing background support. And that's the... I spoke about this once. My Tana quoted Rav Itamar Rodenzweig, who wanted to say that in some respect, we live in America, and we are providing, you know, financing, and we're supporting all the tzedakahs that we give, in a sense, like the Radvaz, we're supporting the war effort in this regard. But the bottom line is that it seems that this is a Melchemes Mitzvah. This is another nation that's trying to, you know, hurt Jews. There's an adversary. October 7th seems, even if maybe you can argue before October 7th, like I think years ago, maybe even before October 7th, there may have been a question, do we really need everyone? You know, we have a large army. I think October 7th and the threat of a war on two fronts, I think demonstrated that we probably do need everyone, and maybe even more. And maybe it means that we need to train everyone, you know, because all of a sudden you can't just call someone up, you know, and say, okay, just, you know, certain people don't have to serve in the army, but if there's a war, then you go out to the front lines. Obviously, you have to train people so they're able to go out. So there's an argument could have been made before that maybe a Melchemes Mitzvah it obligates us to send out everyone only if it's necessary. Maybe it's not necessary. I think October 7th proved that it might be necessary. First, you got someone in the comment, Evan, then Heshi, yeah. The civil war, right? So the Radvaz. That's I think that's right. That's the Radvaz. Radvaz is providing food and water and the civil war. Exactly. Yeah. Right.
So shouldn't that be reason enough to say everybody has to be involved because it's pikuach nefesh?
Right. So what some will say is that yeah. So they're going to say, let me be very clear. They're going to say that our learning is what's protected. Now, you could disagree with that, but I'm bringing a halachic source which says that everyone. In other words, when you say that we are. That we're doing our part. Like, what does it mean to do your part to help win the war, right? So the point being that what this Gemara is saying, question is, you know, how much you rely on God and how much do you make your own efforts? So the fact that the Mishnah says that everyone goes out to war, even the Chassan and the Kala go out to war, which means that everyone, and not simply, we're gonna daven, or some people will daven. This seems to indicate that everyone who's able, physically able, should go out to war. And if everyone agrees, pikuach nefesh, we have to do our part. But the argument is, what's our part? You know, yeah.
What is the concept? I don't know the answer to this.
Yeah.
Is the concept of pikuach nefesh ever used in a situation like this? A person is sick, so a person that I'm
right.
The taxi, stealing the dog.
Right.
That pikuach nefesh? The guy's attacking another guy. Is there right. A dog? Is there a word? Because you right. Know, that is. Do we ever find that is a utilization of the
concept right.
Of
pikuach nefesh? So I'm saying, so maybe, so again, I think maybe before October 7th, one could have argued if there are maybe enough people who are fighting, then maybe some people could die, some people could fight, maybe. I mean, that might be an argument. Okay, but I not yet.
Is what they're using like a Yisachar Zvulun type of paradigm?
Right.
Because even Yisachar Zvulun, whatever that relationship was, if there was a war, both Yisachar
right.
And Zvulun.
I understand.
And you even have Devorah, she's in Libya, was she also a warrior?
Right. I don't know what she did or what she didn't do, but okay. I'm not sure what she did. But okay, so what they use, I'll tell you the source they use. So there's a Rambam here. Look at the Rambam here. There's a Rambam here in Hilchos Shmita V'Yovel, Perik Yud Gimel, Halacha Yud Beit Yud Gimel. So the reason what the Rambam says, V'lama lo zacha Levi benachas Eretz Yisrael uve biza sa imechav. So people, sometimes you're going to hear the Haredim say that we are like the Shevet Levi. So what's this coming from? So it says, why doesn't Shevet Levi merit the inheritance of Eretz Yisrael and the spoils of war? Because Shevet Levi was separated. So this is not Yisachar Zvulun, this is Levi and the rest, to serve God, and to show the right paths. Umishpatav atzadik ulerabim. Their judge, their responsibility was to instruct people the right way to follow. Shenemar yo umishpatach liyakov asaros chal Yisrael. So that's the pasuk of the purpose of Shevet Levi. Again, part of Shevet Levi's role was to serve in the Beis Hamikdash, but they were also supposed to be the teachers based on Yaakov's blessing, or certainly based on Moshe's blessing. The ficha chuvdalu midarchei olam, and therefore they are separated from the ways of the world. Lo orchei milchama kishar Yisrael. They don't wage war like the rest of the Jewish people. They also do not receive an inheritance. They don't acquire for themselves through their physical power. Elheim chel Hashem. They are like Tzivos Hashem. They are the army of God. So we say God has blessed his legion. And God provides for them. I am your portion, your inheritance. So Shevet Levi seems from this halacha of the Rambam that their role is not to wage war. We need a certain group that's basically teaching. Now, what are you going to tell me? What are you going to tell me?
Because that's from the Torah. Torah says
okay, but you skipped ahead. Okay, so you can say, well, it's everyone who's not serving the army from Shevet Levi. It's not true. So the Rabbah makes this comment. Right. So below, we're gonna read this, and we'll see how Ravar Lichtenstein, what he writes in response to this argument. Below Shevet Levi Bilvad, and this is not only Shevet Levi. So, but anyone of the inhabitants of the world whose spirit motivates him, and he understands with his wisdom to set him aside and stand before Hashem. Lishar, so to serve him, Ula of Do, and to minister him, Ladeas Hashem, to know Hashem, Vahalach Yashar, and he goes justly, Kamosha, so Elokim, just as God had made him, Uparak Me'al Tzavara, Cheshbos, Arabim, Shabikchu, Bnei Adam, and he's not involved in like all the other calculations, other things that people are seeking. He's just simply him, just focusing on Avodas HaKodesh, holy work. Hareza Niskadesh Kodesh Kadashim. He is sanctified as the Holy of Holies. V'Hashem Chalkov V'Achlaso La'Olam Olme Olamim, and Hashem will be his portion and his inheritance forever. V'Yiskelo Ba'Olam Hazeh Davar Hamaspiklo, and he will inherit this world something which is sufficient. Kemosh Zachal Kon Levim. He may not have the most luxurious lifestyle, but he'll have enough. Hare David Olav Hashem Omer. Behold, David Olav Hashem said, Hashem benos kalki, God is my portion, b'chosi my cup, ato tamalik orli, right? You support my lot. Okay. So how do you, so that they quote this Rambam saying this, we're Shevet Levi. So Rav Lichtenstein is aware of this Rambam. And so yeah?
I'm simplifying. Maybe that says, first of all, you can't be what's in a person's heart, and it's not what he really feels, and it's not unheard of that people have fame and religiosity and can okay. Be to avoid service.
Okay.
So
right. Okay. Okay. Well, I don't know if everyone.
He doesn't make it from Levi, just because he wants it.
I understand. So I want to argue. The question is, obviously, I think Heshi. I think that, just to be fair. So I think that at least in this article that I read from Vin News, that the Haredi part is discussing the new draft law for Haredim not studying full time. So I think that many Haredim will say, many Haredi leadership, at least the rabbis will say, that if someone's not, that again, it's not an exemption for those who are faking it, but my question is, even someone who is studying full time and fully invested, question is, should they still be serving? So to that, obviously you can say if someone's not really doing it, so obviously not. But so let's say someone is fully doing that. So this is why Rav Aaron Lichtenstein writes, the ideology of Hester. So first, the initial postulate, that every Levite enjoys a dispensation from army duty has no source in Chazal. So number one is, Wilstein says, that what the Rambam is right now, he's the Rambam. So you can't just, so yeah. Sometimes you have to know why the Rambam is writing what he's writing. So So you have to understand this, first of all, okay? His first point is that this halacha of the Rambam is not found anywhere in Chazal. Okay, but at the same time, the Rambam writes it, so we have to understand what this is. On the contrary, it contravenes the evident purport of the Mishnah in Sota. Right? It goes against the Mishnah in Sota, which says, in case of wars of mitzvah, all go out, even a groom and a bride. Right? In other words, this Rambam goes against the other halacha that says what? Everyone leaves, goes out to war. I guess you could argue, it says that everyone goes out to war, even the Chasam Kala, but not the Talmud Chacham. That seems very far-fetched. The import of the Gemara, the Mishnah. Right, I understand. Right. But, okay. So you could say that. But if you look in Chazal don't mention this Shevet Levi exclusion. And the simple understanding of the Mishnah in Ksuvos, when you're talking about who goes out to war, and if you read like all the Gemaras, right? You read all the Gemara before you get to the Rambam, you would say what? That the halacha is everyone goes out to war. There's no Talmud Chacham exception. So you have to deal with that. Now, as has often been noted, if the Rambam's formulation is understood as a total bar and army sort of Sheva Levi, it seems contradicted, also the Gemara in Kedushin, which we didn't discuss. Would or should B'nai Torah readily lean upon such a thin reed in order to exempt themselves from saying mitzvahs of lulav or shofar? In other words, there's no. The Rambam is saying something, let's see what it is, but it's not really quoted anywhere in Chazal. He says it seems most unlikely that this statement is indeed all it is presumed to be. See, if you know the Rambam, and you know where the Rambam writes what he writes, it doesn't seem like its intent is what those who want to say there's an exemption, that's what the Rambam really means. If the Rambam had truly intended to postulate a categorical dispensation for B'nai Levi or B'nai Torah, would he have presented and formulated in the manner and context? Given his sharply honed discipline and sense of order, would he not have cited in Hilchos Malachim, together with all the laws of warfare, rather than as a peroration to Sefer Zeraim? In other words, this is his argument. Very often, people who study the Rambam, the question is, where does the Rambam place his halachos? In other words, if the Rambam wants to tell you, okay, he makes an order, he makes an organization, he says, okay, now we're going to talk about the laws of war. In other words, the Rambam has a code of Jewish law, he organizes everything. I want to know, right, again, this is before the Shulchan Aruch, I want to know, what are the rules of war? So I'm going to open up the Rambam, so I'm going to open up Hilchos Malachim, that's where the laws of kings and their wars. That's where all the laws of the Rambam dealing with wars are found. You open up that book, and in that book, there's no mention about any dispensation of Shevet Levi. Where is this dispensation found? The last halacha in Sefer Zeraim, Hilchos Shemitah v'Yovel, the laws of Shemitah and Yovel, what does that do with wars, right? Like, why is this placed here? Very often, the Rambam, if you're familiar with the Rambam, very often at the end of a lot of his books, he writes a nice, like, hashkafic piece. Like a nice hashkafic. Look what he writes. Look what the Rav Lechti writes. The implication is clear. What we have here is a hortatory coda analogous to the conclusions of many books of the Mishnah Torah, but is not to be confused with the clear halachic mandate. It provides a vivid evaluation of an inspiring personality, but does not dictate how it or others should act. In other words, what the Rambam writes, let me just finish everything, I'll take a comment on it. Let me finish the whole piece here. In other words, what he's saying is the following. If the Rambam really meant that there was an exclusion, you would put it in Hilchos Malachim. What the Rambam commonly does at the end of some of his Sfarim is he writes a nice vivid picture. It's like what he writes is, you know, there's a mitzvah of tzedakah, but you know what? It's Shevet Levi, and people are Talmidei Chachamim. Hashem will protect him. It's good to be someone who is totally devoted to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's more of a hashkafic piece, as evidenced by the fact, if you look at his last halacha that's found, the last halacha found in all of his books, right? There are 14. It's called his code of Jewish law. It's called the Yad Chazakah. Because Yad, that means hand, and Gematria is 14, right? So there are 14 books. Usually the last halacha in each of the Yad Chazakah is a nice hashkafic idea, saying, you know, talk about some kind of inspiring personality, an inspiring way to live a life. And so, okay, so he puts this idea, we should try to be like Shevet Levi, we should try to be inspired. But if he really meant a real halachic exemption from war, you'd put it where? In the laws of war. That's what he says, number one. And then he says more than that. Even if we grant that the Rambam statement does imply a categorical dispensation, in purely halachic terms, if you want to say, which it looks like disagrees, if you want to say it's a real halachic exemption, it remains of little practical significance. We have yet to examine just to whom it applies. Levi is defined genealogically. Okay, fine. If someone's Shevet Levi, he has the exemption. Those who are equated with him, however, literally or symbolically, are defined by spiritual qualities. And for these, the Rambam sets a very high standard indeed. So we don't have to go to what you're saying, actually, that some people may not, they may fake it, they may pretend to learn to get out of it. He's saying, even people learn full time. The question, do they even measure up to what the Rambam is describing? He presents an idealized portrait of a selfless, atemporal, almost ethereal person, one whose spirit and intelligence had led him to divest himself of all worldly concern, and he was devoting himself to stand before God, to serve him, to worship him, to know God, and he walks aright as the Lord has made him, and he has cast off his neck, the yoke of the many considerations that men have sought. Erlichsid asks, to how large a segment of the Torah community, or Kal Vachomer, a fortiori, of any community, does this lofty typology apply? 2%? 5%? Can anyone... Look what he writes. Can anyone who has negotiated the terms of a salary, perhaps even of a Nadin or Kester, both, not sure, look into a mirror and tell himself that he need not go to the army because he's Kodesh Kadashim, Sanctum Sanctorum, in the Rambam's terms? Can anyone with even a touch of vanity or concern for kavod contend this? So he's not even saying, forget about people who are faking or not faking. He's saying that, number one, Number one, he's saying that if someone studies the Rambam and understands when the Rambam is writing halacha and when he's writing like a nice hashkafic piece, especially a hashkafic piece that's not found anywhere in Chazal, it's clear the halacha is that everyone serves. Again, maybe if they would have said there's an exemption from a chasson and there's an exemption for Tamid Chachabim and it was in Hilchos Melachim, maybe you'd have the argument. It doesn't say that where it's supposed to be. It's not found in Chazal. This is more of a hashkafic piece. And even if you want to say it's a halachic piece, which he finds very hard to believe, how many people would it apply to everyone? Sorry, first Howie, you had a comment in Evan, yeah? Yeah. Right. 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 So notice I didn't mention anything about a Jewish state or not. The argument. Wait. I heard what you said. Let me respond. The argument of Milchemes Mitzvah, and they don't make that argument. A Milchemes Mitzvah is when Klal Yisrael, whether there's a Jewish state or not Jewish state. The Rambam writes. Right, what's the lashon of the Rambam? The lashon of the Rambam doesn't say Jewish state, non-Jewish state. The lashon of the Rambam is that what's a Milchemes Mitzvah? It is Ezras Yisrael Miyad Sar Shebaalehem. That's whether there's a Jewish state or not. This says helping Klal Yisrael from the hands of an adversary that comes upon them. Whether you hold a Jewish state, whether you don't hold a Jewish state, and what the Charedi's role of view of Zionism, that's, first of all, it's evolved a bit over the past 50 years, or past 75 years, but it's not an argument based on a Jewish state or not. Their argument, if you hear the Charedi arguments, it's not based on that. They say that Jewish people need protection, but our Torah study, Nevoas Hashem, provides the protection. Yeah, Evan? Right. Correct. Right. Okay, so first of all, you can disagree with that theory. I'm just saying, you can disagree with that theory, but yeah, I mean, you're not trying to convince me. But there are many examples, like, you know, many of our heroes, Avraham Avinu fought wars, Don Melk fought wars, right? I understand. I'm going through the arguments. So again, the arguments, generally speaking, I think the more halachic arguments that are generally brought are, number one, the Torah protects them. We sort of discussed that. Number two is this Shevet Levi argument. And for me, I actually think the real argument, which is not said all the time, I think this is the real argument, which is that the culture, they won't say that, but I think this is the real argument, in my opinion. I think that the culture of the army, they're going to argue, is not suited for Torah. Let me explain. Many Haredi leaders argue that the attempt to enlist the Haredim is a deliberate attempt to secularize them, to peel away from Torah, religion, and Torah study. I think the major objection to army service is the overwhelmingly secular environment. And I think they don't trust the Israeli government. I think that's, in my opinion, whatever they're saying, I think that is ultimately, I think that there is a feeling ever since the creation of the state between the secular and the Haredim, there is, neither side respects each other. So I just don't trust you. I don't trust that if I send my boys to your army, whatever you promise me, I just don't trust you. You know, the Haredi community was not going to place their young sons during the most impressionable years of their lives in the hands of a government that looks at their way of life with disdain, contempt, and outright hatred. And I think initially, and I think maybe things have changed, I think initially the key factor which shaped the worldview of secular Zionist thinkers was a nationalism based not only on the notion of creating a physical Jewish homeland, but also of creating a new kind of Jew to build and maintain this homeland. Many of these early Zionist thinkers felt that centuries of ghettoization and persecution had robbed the Jews of their pride and strength. To build a homeland required a proud, self-sufficient Jew, a Jew who could farm, who could defend himself and build the land. The pious, poor, ghettoized Jew who presented a pathetic image of a man stooped over and always at the mercy of his persecutors had to be done away with. To build a state required something altogether different, a Hebrew. The early Zionists themselves called themselves Hebrews and not Jews, and deliberately changed their German or Russian Yiddish names to sound more Hebraic and nationalistic. David grew and became Ben-Gurion, right? Shimon Persky, Shimon Peres. It was a deliberate attempt to create a totally new Jewish identity and rid themselves of any aspect of the religious diaspora Jewish identity. These early Zionist leaders knew, of course, that religion had preserved Jewish identity in the ghettos and shtetls of Europe, but the modern Jewish state, they felt there was no need for it. Of course, the Bible would be used as a source of Jewish history and culture, but there is no room for religion and ritual in the modern Jewish state. I think that the Haredim feel that secular Israelis disdain, not all, but I think there is this feeling of disdain, their way of life, and thus they do not trust that the IDF will be sensitive to all their needs. Again, I don't think, let me be clear, I don't think that excuses them. Let me make my point, don't take your question. I don't think that that excuses them from serving the army. It requires serious conversation to find ways to gain comfort that they will be able to lead a fully Torah lifestyle in the army. Rabbi Tamir Granot is the Rosh Yeshiva of Orod Shaul. It's a Hester Yeshiva in Tel Aviv. His son, Amital, was killed in the early days of the war. He issued a heartfelt message in which he addressed, this is in response to Rav Yitzchak Yosef's concern. When Rav Yitzchak Yosef said, if they try to enlist us, we're going to leave the country. And you know, his is for many people, his kids, his son was killed in the war. You can imagine how he felt. He, I don't know if you've seen it. I'm going to read you a piece of what he wrote in response. And this is a response, both addressing Rav Yitzchak Yosef's assertion of how it's forbidden to serve in the IDF, and also he addressed liberal secularists on the left. This is a part of what he wrote. He said, what in Rambam's words make you presume that he exempts one from this war? In Hilchos Malachim, when he lists military exemptions from certain people, does he give, obviously he said this in Hebrew, it was translated, does he give a pass to Torah students? Even a groom from the bridal chamber and a bride from underneath her wedding canopy go out in defense. Where is there an exemption for Torah students in King David's army? Were the Torah students exempt? At least be honest and say it's a matter of hashkafa, your religious worldview and sensitivities, that because you are Haredim, you fear the danger of encountering the outside world. This is true. There is such a danger. And we all bear responsibility for Yiras Shemayim and Yiddishkeit. So tell your rabbis, let's not act like little frightened children claiming that the army cannot accommodate us. Rather say, we wish to fulfill the mitzvahs of the Torah and to be partners with the people of Israel. We want to serve in the army. Let us see how it can be done, how we can find proper and correct arrangements according to our specific needs, as was done for the students of the Yeshivot Hester, who combined study and service. And if that does not work, the army will find better ways to accommodate. This is because it will be better for all involved, soldiers, commanders, and the army alike, to have God-fearing soldiers serving in the army and emerging even stronger. Your Torah will be even more complete, not a Torah cloistered in its own four cubits, but one that fortifies the land of Israel and the hearts of the people of Israel. How does the Torah connect with the people? It can be done. You tell the army what you need, and the army will say what is possible. Don't speak like children. The army doesn't want us or refuses to accommodate us. The army wants you and is ready for you. Take responsibility, my friends. It's a responsibility for the entire Jewish people. Finally, I want to say something to our secular brothers. It is impossible to deal with this issue of the army and yeshiva students without speaking honestly. Here we must address two issues. Those of you, obviously not all of you, who during the recent national strife around the judicial reform called for an end to volunteering, for refusing calls to reserve duty, or for not conscripting, need to mend your ways and admit your error. Only then can you talk about drafting yeshiva students. If for any number of ideological, liberal, or secular reasons one can stop enlisting or volunteering, then the Haredim are justified for making a similar claim on the right. But none of these reasons legitimately exempt a person from enlistment in the army or national service. To speak of drafting Haredi yeshiva students fairly and with love, and for it to actually succeed, we must be honest and admit that there are also secular Israelis who dodge enlistment. And a second matter, as far as Haredi enlistment and the Torah study exemption goes, it is important to understand what Torah learning is, to value it, and to talk about it with respect and appreciation. Without Torah study, the Jewish people would not be here today. Without 2,000 years of Torah study, we would not have returned to the land of Israel, and the people of Israel would not be what we are morally, spiritually, or intellectually. There can be no nation of Israel without Torah study and yeshivot of all varieties. And you, our secular brothers, should tell the yeshivot, we want yeshivot, and we will never harm them. We also wish to learn Torah in our own way, and we will defend and support yeshivot if you will be our partners. That's what you should clearly and loudly tell the Haredi. We will help you. We will uphold the yeshiva. We will accommodate your Torah study and Yiras Shamayim, but be partners with us. In this way, by extending a hand through appreciation, by understanding the respect due to Torah and its value, change can really occur. Our situation is dire, But this crisis can give rise to a great transformation in the relationship between the Torah and the people of Israel. The entire nation can draw closer to the Torah, and the people of the Torah can be much closer to the nation of Israel. I hope and pray that my words will be received with love. Seems to me, and I'll take your questions in a minute, seems to me in this regard that change, I think, can only come from grassroots efforts of Haredim coming forward and saying we want to serve, by saying it's our duty to serve, and by the IDF being very accommodating. I think it's going to be a slow process. You know, we want now. In my view, this is really the only way for all citizens to eventually appreciate their halachic responsibility to serve in the IDF, to really build trust, work with accommodations. It might be very slow. It might be with perhaps initially with Haredim who cannot serve, who cannot learn full-time. You know, some say maybe lower the stipends, you know, politically, lower the stipends for the yeshiva people to force them to serve. Maybe that'll work. I think long-term, the way it might work is there's a feeling of trust and respect and an understanding and accommodation, because I think that's the real issue, in my opinion. And if to the extent that we are successful, then this will be a way that the Haredim hopefully will be a long process to appreciate their halachic responsibility to serve in the IDF, to defend the State of Israel and the people of Israel.